ridiculous, this whole dialogue about his criminal capability. The question that should be before the courts can decide is whether or not the man in fact committed a crime. Insanity should not be a defense at all. And then you bring in the psychiatrist when you try to determine what kind of correctional remedy you're going to use. And,
I think that's right.
The trouble is, if you go that far, then you're smack into a due process.
Well, I can't imagine that we can't fire ourselves. I think society certainly has a legitimate right to protect itself against people that are dangerous.
How much difference is there between right and wrong test and this mental disease or defect which renders him incapable of conforming or understanding?
The first part of this is more liberal.
Yes, that's all. But, and I would buy that, but because I don't think we can accurately define the dimensions of the control test, and because I think it necessarily has to go beyond the mental disease or defect test if it means anything, and if it doesn't go beyond, we don't need it. Those reasons I question the wisdom of the plea. Professor Platt, you were...
I think that the Attorney General certainly has a good point, and especially in light of, I think we must look beyond our immediate problems here. Most of us here are lawyers, and we're used to dealing with legal concepts, but this is going to be, after all, a legislative problem. And the people of Oregon are going to be looking at this kind of provision very closely, and their reactions are going to be, I think, much the same as been presented here already this morning. Aren't we really lessen or increasing the possibility of dangerous people on the streets again through a more liberal insanity defense? And we're going to have to answer that question. I think there are some good answers to it that we ought to keep in mind that we're certainly going to have to make before not only the legislature but the people at large. In the first place, I don't think this is all that much more a liberal test, because just as background, I might remind us all that the Oregon cases consistently over the years since 1884 have applied a much more liberal version of McNaughton than it looks like on the surface. I think Jim will attest to this, that almost invariably evidence of the ability to control or conform is allowed to go to the jury, if there is a jury or the judge, if he's sitting alone. Comes in all the time as a matter of course. Nobody objects anymore to that kind of evidence. In effect, the jury is getting the control kind of evidence now. So we aren't really changing that. All we're doing is allowing the court to instruct the jury in an official way that they may consider the evidence. That's really about the only change that I see. I don't think it's going to increase the number of people who are successful on that issue of control. And even if it does, then we must remember the next essential block of our work, which is the procedural aspect that's so important. And we're making a major change in this area that now affects the people who managed to get in under the insanity defense successfully. All right, what happens to him then? What happens to the man who commits an atrocious rape and the court or the jury, the fact finder, is convinced that he's not responsible under the responsibility test? In short, he's insane. Then we look at Section 10 of this draft, which says that one of three things may happen to him. The judge may commit him to the institution if he's dangerous. And we define dangerousness for the first time in this draft as being dangerous to his own person or the persons of others. Now, clearly, this would cover the dangerous kind of a proclivity to go about the streets raping attractive ladies. Or he may release him under appropriate circumstances, or he may release him to supervision. And no longer will the dangerous person be discharged by the doctors in the hospital. I think this is an important change also. That now exists. The hospital discharges without a fairly well to the court. Now, if the hospital wants to discharge this previously found to be dangerous person, it must come to the judge and prove its case. And the judge will then decide whether in fact he should be retained or whether in fact he should be released. So I think that we are now building in some safeguards that did not exist, even if this test is applied or results in a so-called more liberal application of the insanity defense.
Okay, then George, what you're saying is the state hospital is going to have some just plain prison cells out there for those people who, as far as they are concerned, are not mentally ill or not in need of treatment, that really belong out to the penitentiary. So as far as they're concerned, they should not be there now. But because they're allowed to go out and rape again or kill again, and the judge won't let them turn loose, as far as being in the state hospital for treatment or mentally ill, they shouldn't be there. So what we're saying is then the state hospital is going to have to develop a prison cell out there where they can hold the people that should be in the penitentiary. Because the judge doesn't feel that he can let them go because they're dangerous.
Well, you must remember that the fellow has to be insane as well as dangerous to get discharged. He must still be mentally defective and dangerous. If he's only dangerous, he has to be released. It's a due process.
Well, I thought you said that the judge would make the determination whether he's dangerous or not.
Well, that's one of the aspects. I perhaps overstressed it, but he has to also prove that he's no longer suffering from mental disease or defect and is not dangerous. It's possible that we may be putting people away in institutions forever, and I think that probably exists. Psychiatrists tell us there are certain things that they just simply can do nothing to it. The fellow is dangerous, and he ought to be put away for the safety of society.
This is the question that it seems to me that we're all kind of in agreement that this is basically a correctional problem. Where do we send this guy? And why do we distinguish on the basis of an individual who doesn't appreciate the criminality of his conduct or is totally unable to conform his conduct to the requirements of the law? I think considerable ignorance. I have a hard time believing any psychiatrist can really pin it down who is the individual who cannot totally conform his conduct or the person that partially conforms, and why should we make a distinction in the law as between these individuals?
Well, of course,
or might not be able to conform his conduct.
Well, of course, you overlook the fact that up until now, in most states, and certainly in Oregon, we have had regularly psychiatrists coming in and counting the number of angels on a different head of the pen when we talk about the difference between right and wrong. That's, for my money, listening to these guys, it's equally as vague and equally as witch doctorish much of the time. We have to have some kind of a test, and there isn't any question that psychiatrists criticize, with, I think, a good deal of validity, the foolishness and the lack of objectivity and the lack of clarity in the non-test. And I think we ought to have a test that more nearly meets reality in terms of what little we know about mental illness. And I want to make a point again that in my opinion, in the judge-decided cases, I'm satisfied that this change will not materially affect the outcome of the vast majority of cases. And I think the only study we have had showed that, as far as the juries are concerned, the difference between McNaughton and ALI is minimal in what the jury response would be. I don't think you're going to get that big of a change. That many more persons are going to go the hospital route instead of the prison route when you get all three of them.
Well, whether this approach makes sense, doesn't make much more sense than what we've got today. Is there possibly another direction to go? My thought is that the psychiatrist should not be in a court.
What is a germ?
Yeah, product.
Product of mental disease.
Yeah. Bruce, you were about to say something.
Oh, I was about to disagree that the basic principle that we're after is where to send the guy. I think there's more important than that, and that's what you're coming with, and his family and everybody else, but the criminal mark where to send him is the practical thing that the judge is faced with, but there's something bigger than that in the criminal prosecution, and I think it's important to keep that in mind.
And I think this would come closer to doing justice in that area than the McNaughton rule.
And I think that from the point of view of where to send him, this is no different than the McNaughton.
You know, one other,
we have now.
Yeah. One other thing that we have to consider is that for a number of sessions, the legislature resisted changing the McNaughton rule. And it was debated in both houses at great length and in committees. And didn't we finally abdicate and change the McNaughton rule, and we adopt in 61 or 3, and we came to this, so we have some legislative history here as to what will be acceptable or will not be acceptable. And it took a long time. I remember in 57 and 59 and 61, and even prior to that, this every session this thing was put.
Didn't George Little Loomis's committee recommend, and it was largely the result of the impetus of that commission that produced the successful bill in 61.
That's right, yeah, they were getting it out 59. That's where that bill came from.
But it had been introduced, and work had been done on it in earlier sessions as well.
Frank?
I don't feel, as Judge Ruth pointed out in the transcript of the testimony that he sent out, that the psychiatrist, the defense psychiatrist, were anyway limited in their testimony in a trial under the not rule that presently stands. I think the jury hears the evidence. I think the monotony test, whether it's right or wrong, is a test and instruction to the jury that they can understand and make a better, from their standpoint, better determination. I think that once we get into this type of a test, I may be basically prejudiced against psychiatrists who court. But this test is going to make the role of the defense psychiatrist much easier under the present test than the usual insanity case that we have. And there, if it's clear that the guy is insane, well, he's committed to the state hospital, typically. And there are those that are both sides of being insane. But this where the test is just a defense thrown in, it's going to place the defense psychiatrist in a much more comfortable position than he is now. And under the present test, he many times has a hard time justifying his position. Under this test, it's going to place the psychiatrist testifying for the state in a much more difficult, in a much more uncomfortable position in trying to justify his opinion that the person is criminally responsible. And, I just had a case with Dr. Hugo, and he said he would have been criminally responsible in his opinion under this test also. But in testifying to that, it would have been a trial for this case that he would have had a much more difficult time testifying. I just don't think there's any necessity in changing the non-rule as it now exists. I mean, it's more than the right or wrong test that comes in, particularly be this last clause that just conform his conduct to the requirement of law, seems to just open up for almost any defendant to come in with the insanity.
What do you know?
More so, under the word appreciate. The psychiatrists have used that word in the testimony before, but I don't want to let them in.
Of course, the Oregon Supreme Court has come pretty close to appreciating that with some specific.
What do you three fellows at the end of the table think? We've been quite rather silent.
We're talking a little bit for practical matter. First of all, it's not that much different. Second of all, something to do with the testimony of the Jim was before,
they were at a full commission.
Yeah, full commission meeting.
Having a little problem with themselves.
Yeah, they didn't seem like
it. Right, no. Except they didn't like any tests, as I recall. And I can see the problem there. And I think the real practical impact is that it's what the psychiatrist testified and the jury is. I mean, it's much different from the right now. So if I disagree in a close case, you're going to find the psychiatrist honest difference in opinion on both sides between these two approaches.
Well, I am going to point to make this one point. I think I've been read on this, but it makes it very valid. Putting a psychiatrist in the courtroom, putting him in a position that he is really not even trained. This is not his avocation. His job is to treat the patient.
Diagnose.
What?
Also diagnose.
Yeah, but he's not diagnosing. He's diagnosing towards treatment.
That's all he's doing.
To some legal standard that he doesn't even understand.
Well,
Mr. Chairman. Let me ask a question. Does the commission agree that by substitution of the word appreciate, that we are liberalizing the Naughton rule, substituting appreciate or no? We're liberalizing it there.
I think
there. Yeah.
Definitely in Naughton, Bennett knows the difference between right and wrong timing. Didn't know the difference between right and wrong, then it's a defense. Here, do we also agree that by using the word mental disease or mental defect, that
that's
we're liberalizing
it? Yeah. Defect?
Yes.
So there again. Now, and thirdly, what about the use of the expression substantial capacity? That is another liberalization, isn't it? Gives the psychiatrist one more place to hang his hook. Well, it seems to me, I would support that. I would support the New York rule, Mr. Chairman, simply because this control test, if it's related to mental disease or mental defect, I don't see what it adds to the rest of the subsection.
Would somebody read that New York rule to us? You happen to have it.
No, but if you look over on page 6 of the preliminary draft number 4, you'll see under derivation the explanation of it.
The New York rule includes all of the monopenal code with the exception of the last phrase, or to conform his conduct to requirements of law. I believe it contains the substantial capacity and appreciation.
Yeah, right.
The commission notes, by the way, in New York, were quite frank to state the reason why the control test came out was because of pressure of the District Attorney's Association in New York.
I never heard of such a thing.
Well, I think we ought to remember
New York and
the Naughton rule, from the very outset, is a prosecution rule because the Queen and the all sorts of royalty put the judges' feet to the fire to develop the rule because of because the McNaughton, you'll recall, tried to kill the Queen's prime minister. And there had been several attacks on not only the Queen, but also her prime her ministers of state. And there was a great outcry against letting these people off. And they said the Queen, historically this is, wrote letters to the judges, and they called the judges before the House of Lords and said, we want an insanity test stated here. And obviously, the pressure of the establishment of that at that time. As a result, the McNaughton rule is quite heavily oriented toward the prosecution. Now, with respect to Senator Burns, if you take out the word appreciate...
No, I don't want to take it out. Okay. I'm going to leave it in. Only thing I wanted to take out is the last three or four words, George. And I guess the reason I want it is because I don't understand it. And if you say they relate to mental disease or mental defect, what do they add?
I'm reading the old irresistible impulse test in new words, whatever that is. I don't know anything.
Well, they certainly relate to mental disease or defect.
It's clear that that's all they relate to.
I think so.
And that they don't broaden it any further than mental disease or mental defect. So, then it's one thing, but if he has a mental disease or mental defect because he's just a sociopath and won't conform to the law, then that's another thing, isn't it? And I would further suggest that I think we'll see a dramatic swing in the direction away from sanity pleas in front of the courts alone in the event that this is passed. There's no question about it.
Well, I'm such a difficult prediction to make.
Well, yeah, I think they're surprised because of the rules of the Monroe County judges and their interpretation of the not rule that leads defense attorneys to waive jury. I don't think the rest of the place around the state that you have this, except in a case where basically what you're doing is going in on a stipulation that he's insane if they go to just before the court. But usually, elsewhere around the state, they want the jury because they feel they have a better chance with the jury than with the judge. And, I agree with you that it's probably change it.
Well, the fact that she had added sub 2, repeated conduct, is not to constitute proof of his inability to conform. We have taken some of the liberality out of the control test. Are you ready to take a vote on this thing?
Let me just say this one thing. Is there, what Lee mentioned earlier as far as having the test of responsibility and actually insanity, go to the question of really where the person should go, whether he should be sent to the state hospital for treatment if that's his condition, or whether he should be sent to the hospital. Realize that we get into the situation, if we did that, we're almost taking mens rea out of crime. But is there any possibility or any reason to pursue that far further? I mean, we just have to agree that such a thing would be unconstitutional.
Who's in California?
I'm not thinking it's really of the two trials, where one they try whether we commit the act and have a trial against sanity necessarily, but that this is here going to be in front of the judge or the psychiatrist who can testify for the court as far as whether he should be, because of his mental condition, he should be sent to the penitentiary, state hospital, or whether he should be the penitentiary. This may be the, seem to be the best answer to insanity if it can be legally done, constitutionally.
I think
we
apply to the
whenever you have an individual who's for the court, murder, rape charge, whatever it is, and there are two possibilities. He either goes to the penitentiary, or he goes to the state hospital. Which is it best? Isn't it best to err on the side of sending him to the hospital rather than to the penitentiary?
Yes.
And if that is the case, wouldn't it be better to adopt something of this nature? It would seem to me it would.
Well, it depends.
You've got, at least in my experience, the most insane things involve homicide.
Yeah.
I don't know. Standpoint of society.
Also, the question I was, the point I was trying to make is the base of your penitentiary becomes a psychiatric institution to some extent. I mean, the care is there.
Yeah, well, I just question that very seriously.
Well, I agree with that.
It's supposed to be there.
But yeah. Listen, I implied in this proposal this the reform of your correctional system.
We had, about 4 or 5 days ago, two boys, 123 and 126, were quarreling and finally started scuffling in their home. And their father told them to knock it off, and they wouldn't, so he tried to separate them, and they kind of cuffed him about a little. And he got a gun. And he said, "Now you kids either cut that out, or I'm gonna shoot you." So they both, and then he tried to separate them with a gun in his hand. Both of them, apparently, according to his story, started approaching him, so he did shoot both of his two sons.
Killed them?
No, well, one of them is very critical, and the other one is going to live, apparently. But his wife says that he occasionally reaches a point in such a state of rage that he can't control himself. In that situation, would he be better off, what are the possibilities of an insanity defense as against the McNaughton rule? Should that guy go to the penitentiary?
No, he should become a foster grandfather.
Are you ready to vote on this?
Yes, so long as it's understood that the vote is not on the question, it sounds a little bit like, it's not on the question of do we intend to provide comfort more for the defense psychiatrist than the state psychiatrist.
No, yeah. The vote is on whether or not we adopt section 1 of preliminary draft number 4. No, 5. 5. 5. Is there any further discussion? Bearing in mind that everyone seems to agree that this is going to make a hell of a lot of difference one way or another. Call the roll.
Judge Burns?
Aye.
Vanderburn?
No.
Carson?
Aye.
Brock?
Aye.
Haas?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Knight?
No.
Spalding?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye.
Six aye.
Terry. Okay, George, do you want to go on to section 2?
Yes. Section 2 adopts officially what I now believe is the law in Oregon, although it's not stated in a statute anywhere, and that is the partial responsibility doctrine, known in California as the Wells-Gorsham doctrine. And essentially what it is very much like the intoxication defense. The defendant charged with a crime with specific elements, that is purpose or knowledge, say for instance burglary, may raise the defense under section 2, partial responsibility, and introduce evidence as to his mental disease or defect which would interfere with him forming the requisite knowledge or purpose. Intent, I believe, we would use better, but the intent is the word we use. To commit the burglary, that is the breaking and entering with a specific intent to commit another crime. And if he persuades the jury or the fact finder that that is the case, then he may not be convicted of burglary, but of course may be convicted of any included lesser offense. Now, in that, it differs from the responsibility test in Section 1, which is a complete defense to the crime. This is not a complete defense. It's a partial defense, or an incomplete defense, whatever you want to call it. The case law in Oregon is difficult to read because it has never specifically held that the partial responsibility doctrine applies, but in practice, in the two or three cases, I think I have them cited here, the Jensen case anyhow, it seems to apply, at least to approve, of this doctrine.
Discussion? John?
Let me put it in perspective. George, I have a case where a guy, who if he's convicted of the bit, tried to pick up a woman at a bar, just so happened that she was in a wheelchair. She wouldn't let him pick her up, so he followed her out, and she testified in their hearing that he grabbed her purse and sent her wheelchair careening down the street into a lamppost. He never had any intention to steal her purse. He was mad at her, and he was also drunker than that. As a matter of fact, he didn't even run. He just kind of stood there and started walking up the street. Under a partial, if I were to plead partial responsibility under this section, what would I get him for? Or what would the state get him for? What would I be able to get him off on?
Assault of some sort.
But not assault and robbery, not being armed with a dangerous weapon. That's what he's charged with.
If he's successful in defense, he couldn't be convicted. Introduce the evidence to show that he couldn't form the purpose and intent. Of course, that would be true of the defense anyhow, I mean, without responsibility. If he's drunk, he's entitled, under the intoxication draft of the commission, to introduce evidence to show that he didn't have the purpose.
He had no intent.
Right. It has to be the so-called specific intent crime, where an element is purpose or knowledge.
How long do you think it'd take you to find a jury buy such a phony story as that? You wouldn't get a jury in 100 years.
He tried this case.
Oh, not yet.
No?
What, a file affidavit?
Wait a jury to try it.
Yeah, I want to wait a jury to try it. Well, what you're saying is you wouldn't find a jury that would believe what George is saying.
Right. It's very possible.
And take, for example, the Jensen case itself, where which was a particularly heinous case. I recall it was murder, sodomy.
Felony murder, wasn't it?
Felony murder. Very involved a young boy essentially, you have this now in your law. You can make an argument that by reason of mental problem or by reason of intoxication or whatever that you don't possess a specific
134
statute. Yeah, but it sounds scary.
Sure.
Well, you have an awful time getting a decent instruction on that.
Well, I think what they do most of the time, at least when it's on insanity, you just read the statute. That's your instruction.
Well, really, where this comes into play, at least in California, or anything else, is reduction of first degree to second, premeditation and deliberation. That's where part of responsibility comes in. I mean, most of your, it would seem to me that any psychiatrist is going to testify well.
One of the points of having this here, it does give the jury a way out. Instead of an either or, he's guilty as charged or he's insane, this allows some a much more subtle treatment of this particular defendant. It allows him, if he's successful in that, and I agree that he's going to have a terrible time proving partial responsibility, but in the appropriate case, rare though it may be, if he is entitled to show that his mental capacity due to disease or defect such as to reduce his level of culpability, then we ought to allow the jury to reflect that in its finding. Now, we do this in intoxication traditionally. We do it with respect to self-defense traditionally. It's really the same kind of thing. The heat of passion crime and self-defense allows the jury to apply really a sort of semi-insanity test to that particular person.
The burden is on the defendant.
Yeah, right. We're placing the burden on the defendant all the way through here. One, the burden is on the defendant, but we are quiet about it, we're silent about it, as with respect to section two, because it's a mens rea element that the defendant should not have to prove any more than he has to prove intoxication.
Burden is on the defendant on total responsibility.
Total responsibility.
Excuse me.
Constitutionally, we couldn't provide the burden on the defendant here. I don't think we can in the first place, but I'm not going to.
The burden is on the defendant by ponders the evidence. You fool around with that quite a bit, but you went back to the way it is now.
The way it is now. Yeah, that's right.
But
not with respect to partial responsibility.
The burden is not to put it on.
You're on the state if he raises the issue. To prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he's guilty of burglary.
Perhaps, I mean, that isn't it.
No.
So they have to prove the various elements, including intent.
Well, you see, in the culpability statute, a section on intoxication, we're silent with respect to intent. I mean, we didn't follow the present statute and use the language intent. Here, we tried to pick that up. And I was just checking to see if this is inconsistent at all with our intoxication.
It may very well be. The language ought to be adjusted, I think, to make it reflect the same policy.
I thought that's what we did.
And what is 136, whatever number it is?
400.
400 say.
I don't
recall
the intoxication draft that's
finally
adopted by the commission.
Well, it reads intoxication. That's page 4 of the seminary draft. And we use the language, evidence of intoxication of the defendant may be offered by the defendant whenever it is relevant to negative an element of the crime charged.
I guess this isn't.
No, it's not inconsistent with the language.
I'll move the approval of section 2, Mr. Chairman.
Defer the motion. Is there any further discussion? If not, the clerk will call. Didn't we approve this once before?
I don't think we took
section
a vote on any of the
sections. No, we did not.
No, we did not.
There wasn't a vote. We didn't act responsibly.
Call the roll.
Is
All those.
Aye. You guys won't be re-elected.
What do you mean? We're going to put them all in jail.
That's the only way we can stay in our jobs.
Well, I'm
going
to. In practice, it certainly is.
Yeah.
I don't know if you got any instructions. Section 3.
Section 3 makes no change in the Oregon law. The burden of proving the responsibility is on the defendant by the preponderance of the evidence.
I move we adopt Section 3.
I move to do it by unanimous consent.
Any discussion? Call roll on Section 3.
Section 4. Section 4 varies somewhat from the original preliminary draft number 4. The commission decided that the language with respect to the kind of notice given was vague, and the draft reflects and hopes successfully to make more clear the cross-reference to the kind of notice that's provided. And the section essentially provides that the defendant may not introduce evidence on the issue of criminal responsibility, that is the total offense under Section 1, unless he gives notice of his intent to do so in the manner provided in Section 6. And we'll look at that detailed provision, which really reflects what the present law now is with respect to notice of the insanity or responsibility of offense.
The only question I have, where the final line?
Well, 6 operates on 2 sections, and I simply thought as a matter of drafting, and there's no other reason, there's no substantive reason for it, that Section 5 also incorporates, by reference, the provisions of Section 6. Section 5 is also a notice requirement. In this case, where the defendant wants to rely on partial responsibility under Section 2, he must give notice of his intent to do so. Now, Section 5 has the additional provision that the effect of which is the defendant who's going to bring in lay witnesses to show partial responsibility need not give the state notice. And I believe that the district attorneys agreed that that wasn't necessary, those who appeared at that commission hearing. But if he's going to bring in an expert, he must give notice in the same manner as he does under Section 1, under the terms of Section 6, which provides for the notice situation.
George?
Yes.
On the intoxication,
I don't present law?
Yeah, he doesn't have to.
No, he does not.
What if he brings in both? On intoxication. He calls a few lay witnesses and then an expert.
He has to get notice?
Not now.
No, under this.
This is changing it. This would.
Well, intoxication is not a mental disease or defect. No. Let's remember that.
Oh, that's
and that,
yeah.
That throws
right.
It out of this article entirely.
Yeah.
So we're really distinguishing between the defendant that is just objecting to the intent element of crimes and intoxication. Avoid the intent element by expert witness without giving notice of the mental defect.
Yes, and the reason being that the technicalities and the medical evidence is much greater, as we assume that it is, than it would be in the intoxication expert witness.
What was the adoption of Form 5?
Isn't the second sentence, and you put it in the third sentence, in other words,
you're talking about Section 6.
Yeah.
Well,
no, this, it seems to me what that is the second sentence gives him a right to file,
untimely where there's just reason. And the third sentence gives him the right to introduce the evidence untimely, or excuse me, without prior filing if there's good reason for it.
Separate written notice.
It's written. Present law is that way anyway.
Yes, and this really reflects almost exactly the present law, which doesn't mean it's the best in the world by any means.
One option would allow the judge to let him file a late notice, and the other option would allow him to introduce evidence with no notice at all.
I would assume that the judge would be very reluctant to allow that unless good cause is shown. Interrupt the trial.
I know we discussed about delayed witness and this type of thing having to step, but where in section 4, 5, or 6 do we distinguish between delayed witness?
Well,
the only time we mention it is in section 5. That's a partial responsibility. John?
I'm a little bit disturbed, Mr. Chairman, by the use of the word case in chief. Now, does that restrict the defendant at all? The defendant may not introduce in his case in chief expert testimony. Does that come from the present statute? We use on our present notice statute, do we say case in chief?
Your idea is the defendant's case is not a case in chief?
No.
I
don't know.
How can you bring it in on sir rebuttal if there hadn't been something on the state's rebuttal to open the door to it? Presumably some expert or something like that.
Well, I guess. What's that type of statute?
In this case, he may testify himself in his case in chief, but in rebuttal, the state may call an expert witness and might feel justified in allowing him to have his expert witness in sir rebuttal, since he's allowed to bring.
And I don't think he should have to give notice in that situation.
The purpose of this was, if he's going to bring in an expert on partial responsibility, the state's entitled to know about it and to get their own expert. If he doesn't bring it in until sir rebuttal, I can't imagine that being allowed in unless the state itself has brought on an expert on rebuttal.
Well, Don just gave a situation where that might.
In which event,
why should you notice in a case like that?
Yeah, in that event, the state's got their experts, so they're protected.
Yeah. Well, I just wondered if there's any particular reason why you use the words case in chief in part here.
Notice of intent to either prove responsibility or irresponsibility of the defendant.
You mean if they were going to, if the state was attempting to prove responsibility by use of expert witnesses?
Right, the only was our situation.
Well, there's a state case that would already have been put on one.
Guys should not even worry about it. He might bring his own psychiatrist on to prove that allegation, which he hasn't proved.
Frank? It could be a situation so unusual that the state might feel, well, the jury is going to think that this fellow's nuts unless I introduce some expert testimony to show that he was perfectly responsible. And I think Frost has a point there.
Well, but I had the objection thrown in sustained, not particularly on this point, but generally that the question that the defendant's mental condition is his insanity is something for him to raise, and the state itself can't raise it.
Yeah, but when
and so I assume that if the state tried to call a psychiatrist in its situation because of bizarre circumstances, it probably would be objected to.
Well, why would it be objectionable? If the intent is an element of the crime.
Well, would this be some of the same as just the state calling any expert any time saying, in my opinion, this guy committed the crime, taking the case from the jury?
No, I think that's quite a different thing.
Say, like calling a criminologist or something to make her a police officer and say, well, yeah, from all the state's last witness, say, yeah, from assuming all these facts, which I believe, in my opinion, this defendant committed this crime.
No, I think this is more like the introduction of fingerprints. It's a fact. One of the things that you have to prove is the intent.
But isn't the reason for the notice requirement is so the state can prepare its case and examine the guy and this kind of thing?
You have to prove intent, but you don't have to prove sanity.
That's right. You have presumption of sanity.
There's a difference.
Yeah, but what about a mental defect to the extent that the jury might think he's incapable of forming particularly in cases involving specific intent? I had a income tax case where the government had to prove specific intent to evade the payment of taxes. And the prosecutor was awful scared that I was going to be able to demonstrate, not by raising the issue formally, but just let the jury think this poor guy didn't know enough to file any income tax return, or didn't know what the hell he was doing about income tax. They tried to get the court, the federal court, to make me say whether I was going to take that tax or not. So that they could have some evidence of my guy's capacity to know what taxes were. As an example of kind of a thing that the prosecution might be up against. But I can't see anything wrong with this as it is.
Oh, that situation
it
might arise.
You
might bring in
late testimony wide open
for or testify
which
yourself.
Well,
in support of partial responsibility.
Furthermore, the
expert testimony for partial.
The court can permit it under the last section 680, last sentence of section 680, aggravated situation. You can
limit
what the present law is also.
Wouldn't it be better that just have it as far as his knowledge that if the defendant, in the preparation of his case, you know, determines that he's going to call an expert, so he's had a psychiatrist examine the defendant, and he says, okay, I'm going to call you. Okay, then shouldn't he then be required to give notice? I mean, whether he's going to call him in his case in chief or whether he's going to, in his defense is only going to call lay witnesses, say, in hopes that the state will turn around and rebut with lay witnesses so that then he can, in sur rebuttal, bring a psychiatrist on without the state having a chance. That if in his preparation, if he is determined that he's going to call a psychiatrist, call an expert, then he should give notice. And whether he actually ends up calling him or not, the state then has had the opportunity to have the examination. Now, if after hearing, he decides he's going to go just on lay witness, and the state has a psychiatrist, and he feels the defense needs to call a psychiatrist, call his own expert, if he hasn't given notice, then he can request the judge, and if the situation wouldn't delay the trial, and fair play, be all right then to call, the judge could allow him to call without notice. But if in his planning of his case he prepares to call a psychiatrist, an expert, then he should give notice.
On the issue of partial responsibility.
And it shouldn't be limited in his case in chief. He'd say, well, I was going to call it sir rebuttal, so I didn't give notice.
I don't think that's the judge has all the power to prohibit him from calling him on serving vital if it isn't proper. And it wouldn't be proper unless it was an expert testimony in his state.
I can observe that I hardly agree with Frank's comment that a sense of fair play requires notice being given of calling an expert. That doesn't apply to the state of experts of all kinds, not just the psychiatrist. Have some kind of faith taken from the state office.
You go along with that.
Good show.
Let's take these one at a time.
Your
motion on section 4.
Yeah, I reiterate the attorney general's motion.
All right. Would you call the roll on section 4?
Judge Brink?
Aye.
Senator Brink?
Aye.
Carson?
Aye.
Ross?
Aye.
Cobb?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Matt?
Aye.
Spalding?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Carried.
Aye.
Now, motion on section 5.
So moved.
Burns moves. Call the roll. Approved, yes.
Judge Brink?
Aye.
Judge Senator Brink?
Aye.
Carson?
Aye.
Carried. Section 6. We had that good discussion on that. Is there a motion in section 6? Lee Johnson will call the roll.
Judge
Brink.
Aye.
Senator Brink.
Aye.
Carson.
Aye.
Ross.
Aye. That's
Cobb.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Knight.
Aye.
Spalding.
Aye.
Aye. Now section 7, George.
Section 7 essentially provides the upon notice under section 1 or 2, that is upon notice of responsibility or partial responsibility as a defense, the state as of right as a may have its own psychiatrist examine the defendant. The suggestion of Mr. Spalding at that previous full commission meeting, the language was inserted to allow the defendant to object to the psychiatrist appointed by the state. Language in section 7 of preliminary draft number 5, if the defendant objects to the psychiatrist chosen by the state, the court for good cause shown may direct the state to select a different psychiatrist. That was inserted to allow a defendant a fairer psychiatrist in the sense that too many state psychiatrists are predictable in their outcome. Put some flexibility into the system, but allows the court to stay in command of the situation. The section with respect to the right to call the psychiatrist reflects State versus Phillips, which specifically held that prior in existing law. Now, the state has that right when the defendant does give notice of defense of responsibility. We are silent after having long battles over whether to insert language reflecting Shepard versus Bowe and beyond to the effect that the defendant may not be asked any questions, the answers to which might tend to incriminate him when he's being examined by the psychiatrist. We are silent entirely on that subject, relying on the present existence of Shepard versus Bowe and Fifth Amendment provisions to protect the defendant's Fifth Amendment right.
Discussion?
I have a question.
Why
do you feel that the defense should have the right to object to psychiatrists?
For the same reason.
But you don't want people to let us.
Why do you have the right to object to the
I don't feel that way.
By the insurance company?
I personally don't feel that way. This reflects the opinion of the subcommittee. I explained to the former commission hearing that the state ought to have that right.
To depend on it.
I'm sorry.
This is misconstrued
what you asked me.
Well, you could have a real prejudice guy that's.
We had one.
Always available. I'm not quite my finger any district attorney or anything else. I'm just saying what could be. I don't think it is in any place in Oregon that I know. It has been, but it should be. And I'd like to have the clerk have some right to control.
I think it's a practical matter, Mr. Chairman, in Portland. When defense attorneys do make objections to particular psychiatrists being appointed to court, generally settle those objections and appoint somebody else.
Does the court require the defendant at that point to specifically state the grounds of his objection?
I think that's customarily done, yes.
Generally, when you...
What are the...
When the order... When the order is, when you submit the order to the court, you've got to put, have your grounds in there. But the, whether the defendant knew the difference between right and wrong at the time of the commission of the act, and whether he's able to aid and assist.
You mean grounds for objection?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, I think that.
It, or does he
simply
say
the objections
that they don't have a fair examination?
It's a little bit like the old story about the.
Like the affidavit of prejudice against the judge.
About the fellow that started his argument in the Supreme Court by saying, this is an appeal from the court of Judge Burns, and I have other errors as well.
Recently, the Eastern Oregon attorney was appearing before the Supreme Court, and I think it was O'Connell said something. And the attorney said, well, obviously, Justice O'Connell, you don't understand what is involved here. You've been taken over the coals, not by O'Connell, but by everyone else.
It is rather amusing, though, in a case I had recently where the state wanted the psychiatrist and they selected one whom some of the criminal defense bar feel somewhat state-oriented. And so the state insisted they wanted him, and so I invoked the provision of Shepherd versus Bowe, and they had the lawyer there, and they couldn't ask him anything about it, and so on. And lo and behold, the state psychiatrist came in and said, this guy's insane, to the consternation of everybody. So none of them would have.
Let me ask you, right to counsel there, the entire examination.
Yeah, we ducked the Shepherd versus Wolf problem in this draft.
We had it initially.
Yeah, actually it's not so much of a problem here as it is on the competency to proceed. We had more of an argument on that extension. That would be clearly an extension of Shepherd versus Bowe. Shepherd versus Bowe clearly covers Section 1 insanity cases. There's no doubt about that. But the defendant who's being examined by the state psychiatrist is entitled to have his counsel present, and the court cannot, through its power, force him to answer any question that may tend to incriminate. That's what the court had tried to do. Judge Bowe had tried to enforce the psychiatrist's question.
He ordered the defense counsel not to give him any advice.
Right, he ordered him not to be present, not to give him any advice, and all sorts of
You mean he ordered the defense counsel not to ask any questions or give advice?
That's right. All he meant in contempt of court to be dead.
Great.
Well, I think the police, my objection to putting Chevron versus the old statutes is about putting into code what now the Fifth Amendment means, when the Fifth Amendment may in time mean something entirely different. Why be bound to a statute?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I agree with Section 7 and a great vote on it. The question that I have is, I assume that Section 7 is going to repeal ORS 136-6150. Now, that that law provides in a subsequent section that the court shall order the county which committed the defendant to the state hospital for examination to pay for that examination and hospitalization. It's kind of an important thing, and it's one of those little loose ends that we've got. Where do we have it?
It's not, I'm trying to find the section where it is.
I mean, this is a pretrial examination thing, which is different than the procedure back in Section 10 and so on. Now, it could be that we'll set up a separate section in the procedural in the things to provide for that, but I think it's probably simplest just to append it on here.
I don't think that Don heard that. Maybe Roger or Don could respond to that. Could you briefly restate that?
Yeah, Don, this pretrial examination under Section 7 will repeal 136-150, which provides that the county committing the defendant has to pay the state hospital.
Yeah.
And we don't want to lose track of that, or staff council won't give us $99,000 for the next biennium.
I can't tell you where it is, Senator, but we do have that provision within our draft somewhere.
I think it is, yeah.
I can't find it. I know it's in here. It's in a section we haven't looked at yet. I think we'll come to it, but if we don't, you're absolutely
correct. Well, we intend to keep
correct.
It.
Correct, yeah.
All right. Then I'll move
it. As far as I know, I've got it somewhere here. I just can't remember where it is.
I would move to amend the motion by striking the last sentence in Section 7, so that if the under Shepherd versus Gold, the defendant is adequately protected in his examination, I see no reason why the defense can object to a psychiatrist chosen by the state when the state has no right of objection to the psychiatrist chosen by the defendant. So I feel that this last sentence should be stricken.
I certainly second the motion. He's got all these protections that can basically make a psychiatric examination almost impossible. Why should we bend over you many more rights?
Don?
Are you going to, I'm just going to respond to Senator Burns' earlier question.
Well,
it's on page 22 of the draft.
Bruce, I think that this is...
Well,
part
of the reason is because the state works with these attorneys in criminal cases all the time, and the defendant doesn't. And another part of the reason is because, at least I've been in psychiatric examinations, or at least procedure. And to qualify, the psychiatrist to say what he would say anyway, based on his discussion with the district attorney.
I might rebut that to say I had a case where the psychiatrist had already given the defense attorney his opinion that the guy was insane, and for some reason they got screwed up, and the psychiatrist didn't examine him until into the third day of trial, after they had presented one full day of their case.
case if a defense psychiatrist came in and they examined him the night before he was to testify the following morning. It was the first time he had examined this defense, so it works both ways.
The thing is,
Bruce,
I really, it just seems to me, say, the defendant has all these rights, and he can refuse to answer any questions. Have his attorney there, which I think seems to me have any hope that you're ever going to have any kind of valid psychiatric examination.
We're not saying that.
Attorney sitting there.
We're not saying that in this section. That's always been the law.
Certainly. Well, I agree, but if that is the law, I don't see why it's necessary for the legislature to go ahead and give the defendant additional rights. That's my question.
Certainly,
there's a cause.
If the judge to kick that psychiatrist out, that good cause can certainly be shown to the jury.
The defendant wouldn't object.
Maybe not.
You wouldn't object to me calling my cousin as a psychiatrist. You just bring that out of the testimony. You wouldn't object.
That's true, but that's an example of something that could possibly happen. And the state does have a stable of psychiatrists.
I'll give you an example, Mr. Chairman. In Multnomah County, there's a psychiatrist who is in private practice who, for many years, conducted all the mental examinations in the probate court for commitments to damage. And those were the days when, up until last year, 2 years ago, the district attorney had to participate or be present at those hearings. This same man habitually has been called by the state, or requested by the state, and called as a state psychiatrist for about the last 7-8 years. And every time there's a motion made in the presiding judge's court by a defense counsel for a psychiatrist, the presiding judge will look at the DA and he says, "Who do you want?" He'll say, "We want Dr. So-and-so." And it gets embarrassing after a while. Now, it's true that from time to time, I had him once where he testified in 18 straight cases for the state, and in 1920, to the consternation of everybody, the guy was sane. But, I mean, he has to balance it out. But this is a type of a thing, I really think that it's pretty good sense. I commend the second committee on what it did.
I suppose part of it is Shepherd versus Poe offends me.
You want to get back to the Supreme Court by screwing up this section.
I think once you've gone this far, you're claiming insanity, and how do you find out how does the state ever have any chance to find out the guy can completely just sit there and refuse to answer questions?
Of course, these examinations don't have to be conducted at the state hospital. I'm just wondering if what would be the effect in some of the remote eastern Oregon counties where there aren't too many psychiatrists available.
We can get them there all the time.
Yeah, well, at the present time, that's what we do. Well, I don't feel very strongly one way or another about it.
The current hands, they already knew this sentence to control it so that the defense can't be facetious about it.
I really think that reluctant all the time to speak in terms of what the experience is before the visit. I think that John's talking about is absolutely right. There's one guy there that always shows up on behalf of the state. And the fact of the business is, this guy is a state psychiatrist, just like you've got defendants, orthopods, and you've got plaintiff orthopods in Portland and other cities as well. And you know them, and they're just oriented that way. And it seems to me it's useful to have a little bit of leeway there.
what would you do, this may be an unfair question, if the defense objected to a particular psychiatrist and stated at his ground that the state had used him in the last 18 trials and in each instance he had found the defendant to be sane? Would you find, consider that a good cause?
Well, you give the defendant the right to object to a fingerprint expert for the state for handwriting expert.
Well, that's a that's an accurate mathematical science.
I'm thinking about that.
You don't see many disagreements among experts as to fingerprints.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a different degree, but it seems to me that you're handcuffing the state for no real apparent reason, where all the objections have been brought out, they can clearly be brought out.
Well, how are you handcuffing?
You know the defense psychiatrist, you know what he's going to come in and say.
That's the more obvious, Carl. Why not a reciprocal?
This is a reason why the state calls for particular, and they're about going over the state. There probably are three or four rather than just the one that John was referring to, but is that what the psychiatrist's determination is based a lot upon how he feels about the McNaughton. Those psychiatrists adhere strictly to the McNaughton, or those psychiatrists who are more apt in their examination to say he's sane. Those are the ones that the state, because they're under the McNaughton test, one that they will have, will request. And also, it depends on his ability to testify. I mean, a psychiatrist, we have one there, and he'd be a very good psychiatrist, but he just can't testify. He just, well, partly because of his accent or something, you just cannot understand. So it's useless. Although I could probably have him examine almost anybody, he'd say he's sane. But the jury can't understand him, so I'm not going to call him.
What dilemma you got there?
So we can make a libel informant.
You got one up there. Get John's friend up there.
Because it's his ability to testify that makes him so valuable. The reason why the two or three psychiatrists are the ones usually called by the state.
Hire a gun, you want one little shoe.
Have members given any thought to Harold's suggestions and they can apply both to the state and the jury?
There's a little difference on that because it's conceivable, not necessarily it's going to happen. Conceivable, the defendant psychiatrist is actually a treating psychiatrist.
Well, I would object to Harold's suggestion, and I thought of what you were still saying, that the court would take that into consideration. It would be very slow to accept the attorney's objection to the treating psychiatrist unless it was in the agreement to do it.
I think you have due process, probably.
I do too, you know, object to the defense.
I don't see why it would be good. It's a disadvantage.
I'm not. Defense is a disadvantage.
Oh, great. Here we go. The big talk about the overwhelming power of the state.
That's because all defendants are so obvious.
When you don't have the, when you'll say that if the facts are in your favor, pound on the facts, if the law's in your favor, pound on the law, and neither the facts or the law, pound on the table. And so that's usually the situation. Defense is placed.
You left out the prosecutor.
Lee, you don't for a moment mean to say that the state does not have more facilities and more power to investigate and so on than the defense, do you?
I'm not totally convinced that this argument is quite as valid as a lot of people make it out to be.
Multnomah County,
for example, the amount of preparation that a deputy DA goes into Multnomah County for criminal cases is often very, very sketchy. Caseload far exceeds right
there. Well, if they're after somebody.
Yeah.
Well, that too, yeah, well, sure.
Depends on the deputy.
Yes. And that's the guy that we need to protect. neck, wasn't there?
The defense does have the advantage of having a person available for the defense attorney who was there and knows what happened.
Sometimes you can't assist
them. You don't have that in an alibi situation.
Really, the guy you need to defend is the innocent guy, or the same guy depending on what you're talking about. And I can't see that the real advantage flows from that. He has an opportunity to get his psychiatrist just the same way the state has the opportunity to get their psychiatrist. I don't see the real need for it.
Well, the pairs that were divided. First, I'd like to say, if we get, it's now about 13 minutes to 12, if we get downstairs, now we'll be able to find space for all of us. Either that or we'll have to wait about 12
or 13. Let's go now.
And then take a vote on this when we return?
Yeah.
And the advocates for each side, maybe we'll be able to convince some of the others. Let's go down the...
The blue room might open up.
Fly up in the...
They won't know about 5
yet.
Whether group's going to show up or not.